and birds and rocks and things. There was sand and hills and rain. The first thing I met was a fly with a buzz and the sky with no clouds. The heat was hot and the ground was dry, but the air was full of sound. I've been through the desert on a horse with no name. It felt good to be out of the rain. In the desert, you can't remember your name, 'cause there ain't no one for to give you no pain.
Coast AM with George Norrie.
And, of course, our special guest tonight, David Icke. And we'll be back with David in a moment. And then at the top of the hour, next hour, we'll open up the phone lines and give you a chance to chat with him as well, right here on Coast to Coast AM. David, you created quite a stir years ago when you came out with your thoughts and theories about reptilians. I think it's only appropriate that we review that a little bit more for some people who haven't had an opportunity to hear your thoughts on that. The reptilians, how far back are we going?
Well, kind of mid-90s and just after that, I think, I started to come across more and more people all around the world because, you know, I've not sat at home here and in a darkened room coming to these conclusions. You know, I've got off my backside and followed the flow of life, and it has led me to an amazing synchronicity of information. And I've met people all over the world, right up to recent times when I went to South Africa about 3 weeks ago, who have had this same basic recurring experience, and that is of seeing people, apparently human at first, turn into a reptilian type figure and then go back again. What we call shape-shifting, of course, which is a theme of ancient accounts going as far back as you want to go. And this became so compelling in the sheer volume of people that I'd met who were telling me the same basic experience from cultures all over the world. And then you look back into ancient accounts and you find the same recurring theme of people who had the ability to move between human and reptilian form. And in my books, I lay especially ones like Children of the Matrix and The Biggest Secret, I go into this background in great detail. And when you first hear it and you come from the perspective that we are solid beings in solid bodies in a solid world, then of course the idea of moving between one form and another just becomes ludicrous. And like I've mentioned tonight already, George, if we get caught in the implanted illusion that this world is, quote, solid and real in the sense that we perceive it as physical, then things like shape-shifting are one of the examples I was talking about where people go, that's impossible, mate. Don't be daft. You're mad. But when you realize that physical form is actually a hologram, and what a hologram is, it's an illusion. When you have a holographic print, which is a waveform, and you put the laser on it, it's a waveform of whatever you've taken a holographic photograph of, and you put the laser on it, suddenly the image that appeared to be a series of chaotic wavy lines becomes a apparently three-dimensional form of whatever you photographed. You turn the laser off, and it disappears, and you're back to the waveform. And in physics, they have realized in quantum physics that what we call particles take two forms. The particles that make up this apparently physical world, they take a wave form, non-physical, and they take a particle form. And the only time the wave becomes the particle is when we observe it. And therefore, we are like the laser on the waveform of the holograms that we make all the time. We are turning a waveform in our heads, in our minds, into a apparently three-dimensional image. Therefore, once you start to realize that that's what the nature of human form is, then moving between one form and another becomes much more straightforward than if you're talking about some solid body where all the organs have to move and all that stuff. You know, we're so caught in the illusion that so many things that are possible become impossible in our minds because of the limitation of perception that we allow in. And these reptilians, the ones that I talk about, have the ability to move between this dimension and another. And what's happening, the number of times, George, that people have said to me around the world, this thing, as they call it sometimes, just appeared out of nowhere. Well, it didn't. What it did was enter the tiny frequency range that human sight can access. And as it entered that frequency range, boom, suddenly it appeared. This is what's happening so often, George, with what we call UFOs, where people go, honestly, mate, I saw it and then it just disappeared. Well, people go, well, you know, are you on the pop? What are you on? What's happened is it's left the frequency range that that person's eyes can access. And at that moment, to him, it disappears, but it doesn't disappear. It's gone into another frequency of existence, another frequency of reality. And we have been so disconnected by the tiny, tiny area of possibility that we are constantly given from cradle to grave, that all this other stuff that happens outside that becomes dismissed because it's too much for us to grasp, because we're coming from a false reality, i.e. the world is solid. I'm looking at a solid wall here. It can't be. It's made up of atoms. If anyone's seen the inside of an atom, there's nothing in it. Someone once said, if you take the atom to be the size of a cathedral, then the particles within it are about the size of a 10-cent piece.
Exactly.
How can that be create a solid wall? It cannot, but our minds can construct it, and it does, because what we're doing is we are decoding frequency fields into holographic forms, and some frequency fields we are decoding as dense and some less dense, depending on the frequency that we're dealing with, in the same way as I've mentioned that the television is decoding frequency broadcasts into pictures. We're doing the same. And therefore, like I say, this whole shape-shifting thing, which seems ridiculous on one level of reality, becomes perfectly understandable from the bigger perspective of reality. And from a human manipulation point of view, seems very, very clear to me after all these years of research that what is actually happening is this world is controlled in the five-sense reality by people who, to our five-sense perception, appear human. But just beyond that, beyond this visible light range, they actually take a very different form. And some people see this movement between the forms. Other people see the eyes change. That's the first thing that changes. The number of people now who said to me, I saw his or her eyes change to a reptilian state. I saw it,
mate. It's like that person that I was just telling you about last hour.
Yeah, and so these people in these bloodlines that end up in positions of power under different names, and the real power is never put on public display. I mean, the idea that George Bush runs America, I mean, please, you know, intelligent life calling planet Earth here. But it's the people behind the scenes and the entities behind the scenes that really call the shots. But these on public display... often from this bloodline, but a lower level of the hierarchy, because this reptilian stream seems incredibly hierarchical. And so when I went to South Africa 3 weeks ago, I spent 10 days traveling around South Africa with the Credo Mutwa, the Zulu shaman. I mean, in their culture, of the shamanistic level of understanding, the whole reptilian shape-shifting thing is like, yeah, mate, and, you know, it's like part of it, part of common knowledge at that level. They call them the Chitahuri, which translates as the children of the serpent or the children of the python. And it goes way back in their culture, this this group of shape-shifting entities who are actually manipulating human existence. So, like I say, I haven't come up with this as some theory. I've let the information be the lead, not the preconceived idea, because how do you get a preconceived idea that reptilian entities are running the world? I mean, what? I followed the information, and the information just builds all the time. The number of people who come on to me now, because I've become a bit of a magnet for this for obvious reasons, and say that I thought it was only me. And one of the great things the books have done is to show people that who've had this experience, hey, no, you're not going crazy. Loads of people have had it. It's just that they're not talking about it for the same reason you're not. They fear what other people think. And this fear of saying something that's different, that's outside the norm, is the most effective imprisoner of experience. Because the number of people who say, well, look, I've had this experience, man. I could talk to you because I know you won't think I'm mad, but I never talk about it publicly. I won't even tell my wife. You know, there's so much knowledge out there, George, that is not being communicated because of the what I can only describe as psychological fascism that goes on in the world, where people's beliefs have to be defended by suppressing other beliefs that are different.
Where do you believe they came from, these shapeshifters? Another dimension, another planet, or have they always been earthbound?
Well, it's interesting question. My feeling is they're interdimensional. Well, it's clearly they're interdimensional. They have ability to move into this dimension and out again. And you know, those questions are you know, the jury's out for me. But certainly, what Crater Mutwa says and what the African belief is going way back is that they're actually of the earth, and they believe that this planet is theirs, but also we need to appreciate that when we talk of planets, we're again talking of a multidimensional situation. You know, we can look at Mars or we can look at these other planets and we say, oh, there's no life there, mate, they're all dead, look. But what we're looking at is Mars or any other planet from the frequency range of visible light, which we can access with our five senses. Other levels of Mars might be teeming with life in other frequencies of existence. So when we talk about entities from Mars and people say, it can't come from Mars, look at it. It's because it is possible because there are other endless frequency ranges of these planets that we can't access, but life exists within.
How did these reptilians on this planet, David, get so powerful?
Well, it's a simple process of disconnecting the mass of the people from the true understanding of who they are and feeding them a false reality. And it's, you know, when you look at this, you don't need that many to run the show. Take the process very simply in, for instance, the American government. The reason that the candidates attract vast amounts of money, in George Bush's case, record-breaking amounts of money, it's necessary, of course, with him to get him in, are attracting that money from these major Illuminati sources. And if you are someone who is not going to play the game or is not part of the game, then you simply do not attract the money. You end up in a plane crash like Wellston did. You don't run for president and with any chance of victory. And so you, the Illuminati in the background, put the president in place. Then through the president, that's just one position, and look at the power of control in America just by controlling that one position. Through that position, then you decide who's going to be head of the Treasury, who's going to be head of the Pentagon, who's going to be head of the State Department. And those people then decide who's going to be deputy. In fact, they're probably told who the deputy is going to be. And there you have already a structure in which the major departments of state are controlled.
And is this happening?
People below them in the pyramid of the State Department, below them in the pyramid of the Pentagon, take their orders, their direction, and their actions from the top. The number of positions, George, you actually have to control within a government to control the government is ridiculously few compared with the number of people actually in government administration.
So
when people say it's the government, no. And it's not the Freemasons either. It is that which is manipulating through these organizations and imposing its will through them, not everyone that's involved with them.
Is this happening worldwide?
It's happening worldwide, yeah, and it's happening more and more worldwide. The basic progression of this was that these bloodlines certainly had a major base in Babylon, which is now, of course, what we call Iraq. And the ancient Sumer, Babylon, Egyptian civilizations certainly come into this. There was then a movement in terms of focus from Babylon through to Rome. And that's when Rome became the Roman Empire. That's when we had the creation of the Roman Church, which became Christianity. And it's also the reason why, apart from the names being different, the basic story of Christianity is mirrored in the beliefs and myths of Babylon. Indeed, the holy days match as well. And then the progression moved into Northern Europe, Rome and what we call the Vatican remaining a major player, but it expanded up into Northern Europe, where eventually a major headquarters became London, or as some people call it, Babby London. And then we had the major global progression of this when we had the empires of Europe, particularly the British Empire, the French Empire, which very relevant, of course, to North America. And what happened was that the bloodlines and the secret society networks that manipulate the bloodline personnel into power, they went out from these centers in Europe to the Americas, to Australia, to Africa, Asia, all over the place, and colonized them. But there are two forms of control. One has a finite life, one has an infinite life until it's exposed. The one with a finite life is a control you can see. It's fascism, it's communism, it's dictatorship that you can see, touch, and taste, that you can put a name to. Because the people in that form of control know they're controlled. And eventually, it might take some time, the desire for freedom in the human heart will eventually rebel against that. The greatest form of control is control that you cannot see, control that gives the illusion of freedom and choice while fundamentally controlling both. And what happened when these colonial powers, especially the British Empire, started withdrawing and giving freedom to their former colonies is they left out there the bloodline and the secret society network already in place. And they've gone on controlling those countries ever since. The difference is those countries have perceived themselves to be free. If you talk to Credo Mutua, he'll give you chapter and verse on the way that the leaders of black African countries, overwhelmingly after the colonial powers pulled out, were planted people under the control of the former colonial powers. And all that's happened in Africa is that physical occupation has been replaced by financial occupation, and the African countries are as controlled by their former colonial masters as ever they were before, but it's more hidden and less obvious, and therefore there is less rebellion. In America, again, the terrific manipulation of America from outside of America. And once you realize that these bloodlines have an allegiance to the bloodline, have an allegiance to their agenda, and not to the country they are apparently supposed to be members of and leaders of, you start to realize why people like George Bush can be a front man for the economic and military destruction of America, because that's what's going on. I've been talking for years in my books that the plan was to use America to destroy America. For this reason, George, and we're seeing it happen now, the idea is to create a world structure of control, an Orwellian state in which we have a world government that would dictate to every country, a world army that would impose the will of the world government, a world currency which would be electronic, not cash, a world central bank, and a microchip population. People laughed when I said the latter, but it's happening.
What happens is,
it's a simple equation. When the few want to control the many, you have to centralize decision-making so the few are making the decisions and not the diversity of the many, which is something you cannot control. And so what we're seeing now is the destruction of the superpower, China's another that will be brought into this, which is up to now capable of resisting any dictate from any world government. World governments and superpowers don't go together, and they're using America now to destroy America.
Stay with us, David. When we come back, let's find out just how many people we're talking about. I'll be right back.
Podcasting, the new way to get Coast to Coast AM to your computer. Available to all StreamLink subscribers at coasttocoastam.com. Gateway to the West. This is Coast to Coast AM with George Norrie on Premier Radio Networks.
Next hour, we'll open up the phone lines, give you an opportunity to chat with David Icke. I think I'll take some fast blast questions now, and we'll continue the dialogue when we come right back. And welcome back. I'm George Norrie with David Icke. David, Aaron from Denver, Colorado writes, for your views on the rejection of the European Union's constitution by the French and the Dutch. He's saying, do you think those two countries recognize that this could be the beginning of the new world order?
I don't think it's as sophisticated as that, George, because, the numbers that voted against do not relate to the numbers who are informed of what's actually going on behind the scenes. What is happening is that there is an instinct that is beyond words almost, that the power is going further and further away from those who are the victims of the power, that people don't want to go any further. And what I was talking about before the break in terms of to control, the few to control, they have to centralize decision-making, is absolutely precisely the reason for the European Union and why they want an American continent version of it also. It's because once upon a time, we had a tribal situation where the tribes decided on what they were going to do. They were then brought together in nations, if you like, and then from a central point, all the previous tribal groups were dictated to. And in Europe, we've gone now to the European Union, where now the countries are brought together under a central dictatorship. And if you look at the symbol from which the word fascism actually comes, the fasci, it is a series of bound rods, comes out of the Roman Empire, appropriately, with an axe head at the top. And the bound rods represent individuality, and the axe head represents centralized dictatorship of the individuality. And I cannot think of a symbol that would more sum up the European Union, where we have a situation now where if you want to sell vegetables or anything else in the old British system of pounds and ounces, then they will take you to court and prosecute you for not doing it in the system of the European Union. How ridiculous, even though your customers might want pounds and ounces. This is the level of individuality and choice is actually being taken away. Now, we have reached a point where they want to play a major card, George. They want this constitution to create what I've been talking about in my books all these years, right back to "And the Truth Shall Set You Free." They want a president of Europe and a European foreign minister. And that's just a stepping stone to a complete centralized government of Europe.
Will they get it, David?
Well, a number of countries have voted for it. But what they've got caught by is this. One of the greatest forms of moving this agenda on is what I call the totalitarian tiptoe. It's where you're going from A and you know you're going to Z, or Z as you say in America, but you're not going to go in one leap because people will look up and say, what's going on? What's going on here? Because the change is so great. So what you do is you go from A to B and then maybe to E, and then you go down in stepping stones, the totalitarian tiptoe. And each move, each progression towards the long identified and desired goal is projected as completely unconnected to all the others. However, there comes a point and points on that progression where to placate people who begin to say, hold on a minute, you have to say, okay, we'll do this then. One example of this is the Bush administration allowing some so-called sunset clauses in so they could get some great freedom-busting legislation through less molested. So what they had to do is to say that any major change in Europe, don't worry, because any major change in Europe, all countries of the European Union have to agree. And this is what they've got caught in now, because there's 25, and they have to have, according to these rules, 25 saying, yes, okay, we'll accept the Constitution. Now, two of the major players, founder players in Europe, Holland and France, have now said massively in public referendum, no. And now what we're going to see is an effort to somehow override that that situation. And one of the ways that they've done it in the past is that when a country like Ireland and Denmark in various other proposals by the European Union for centralization, etc., and single currency, when they've voted no in a referendum, what they've done is waited a bit and then had another one. And certain key people change sides miraculously, even though the debate is the same. And they basically keep asking the question until they get the answer they want. The problem they have at the moment, however, is that the rejection is so fundamental in these countries, and these countries so important at the heart of Europe, that it's going to be very interesting. I should think they're running around like headless chickens at the moment, but their focus will not be to let it go. Their focus will be, how do we get out of this?
I think you're absolutely right, and sooner than later, don't you think?
Well, they have a time scale. Now, I was saying in the late 90s that their time scale was behind schedule because you know, for whatever reason, the window around 2012 is very important to these people. And what happened then was 9/11. And 9/11 has enormously caught up with their timescale. Not necessarily caught up, but it's advanced it very quickly for obvious reasons. And that, I would strongly suggest, is why it happened. They have a timescale for the European Union, and this threatens to knock it out if they take a long time to sort out this crisis that their agenda is facing at the moment over here. But also on the same subject, as the problems continue in Iraq, as the memory of 9/11 starts to fade and becomes less effective mm-hmm. in justifying the advancement of the Orwellian agenda. There's no doubt, George, 9/11 in other forms is in their pipeline. And my understanding, the more people I talk to, is that 2006 seems to be a year when they might play some of these cards, because to create public, again, everything that we're talking about tonight, no matter what level of it we're talking about, they all interconnect. What we're talking about in advancing this agenda is mind manipulation, reality manipulation. Because they manipulated the reality of the vast majority of people that the basic story of 9/11 was correct, then certain things were allowed, like the invasion of Afghanistan and changes in the Patriot Act and all this stuff. So they are going to be adding to that, so that the increasing resistance to this whole agenda starts to be broken down by, hey, you know, I know it's bad, but we've got to do something with what's happening in the world. There's another terrorism and all this stuff. So, you know, we have got to be very, very wary when these events happen, and ask a simple question. Who benefits? Who benefits from 9/11? Not the people who died. Not the Arab world. Who benefits? Who benefits is anyone that wanted to take basic freedoms away and launch a war on terrorism, which is actually a war by terrorists, in fact.
See, I've always asked myself that same question. Let's clear up this one thing, though, David. Do you believe that this group that helped orchestrate this involved some of these crazed fundamentalists to do the dirty deed, or do you think that they didn't do anything? See, I believe that the Bin Ladens of life were truly involved as well.
Well, when you look at a secret society, it is broken up into levels of degree. Now, levels of degree equals levels of knowledge of what's going on. And all these situations, even like 9/11, they are compartmentalized in terms of how much people know. And there's no doubt that there are people involved in so-called terrorist acts. In fact, not even so-called. When I say so-called, I mean, you know, blaming the wrong people. But there are people who are genuinely involved in terrorist acts who have no idea, going back up the hierarchy, who's actually behind what they're doing. They can think that Master is Mr. A when it's Mr. Z. And so it's all smoke and mirrors, and it's not easy, to say the least, to be definitive on this, and it would be stupid for anyone to think they can be. But my feeling is that an enormous amount of the, or all, really, the fundamental setup and engineering of 9/11 was not involving the Arab world at all. And I'm still unconvinced about the official story of Arab terrorists. In fact, the more that I come across the emerging information about the planes involved and what have you, the less credible this whole thing seems to be. Certainly. I mean, again, you know, intelligent life calling planet Earth. Certainly, people who were incompetent pilots of Cessna aircraft are not going to park 767-757s perfectly into these buildings. I mean, please. The very idea that people can put those two things, see those two things and not put two and two together, that one is not going to do the other, it just beggars belief. So for me, the whole 19 hijackers story is fundamentally flawed. And I think at the very least, the input from the Arab world was tiny in contrast to the engineering of it within the borders of the United States.
You see,
9/11 was created as a problem to get a reaction of outrage and fear and terror, exactly, and understandable, to get the ability to offer the solution, which has been changes in society that George Orwell, on whatever dimension he may be, must be shaking his head and saying, I told you so.
And changes that we have only seen the tip of the iceberg, David.
You're correct. And like I said a few minutes ago, George, to push people further on down this road to global centralized fascism, they are going to need more 9/11 type events to create problems, to create the reaction, to offer the solutions. Because 9/11 is not by itself going to be enough to get people to go with this to the level, you quite rightly say, that they plan to do it. I mean, people say, what would the world be like if these guys complete their agenda? Well, think of Nazi Germany. Make it global. There you go. That's what they want. That's what I've been saying for 15 years. And now, we're seeing.
And you're not backing down at all on this, are you?
No, not at all. Not least, George, because, I'm not the fountain of all knowledge. Is every last thing that I say or write 100% true? Are you kidding? We're trying to understand something that doesn't want to be understood here. But the themes and a great deal of the fine detail is now in front of our face. One of the things that I was talking about years ago, and this is very relevant to what we were talking about earlier in terms of reality and the biological computer, is the microchip. What they're doing now, they're talking about ID cards. This is the totalitarian tiptoe, mate. What they want is microchip people. They want a situation, like I've been saying for 15 years or more, they want a situation where every baby at birth is microchipped. And we're now having nightclubs in places like Spain microchipping people so that they can get through the door and beat the queues easier. I mean, it's all areas are now beginning to justify this, particularly something called the very chip, which comes out of America. And when you understand the nature of the physical form and the nature of the reality that we're in, the biological computer, you start to see the potential, the real potential behind the microchip. Back in about 98, I met a CIA scientist who asked to meet me because he wanted to get out what he couldn't himself. And he told me that they had microchips outside the public arena in the secret projects, which is light years ahead of the technology we see in the public arena, which are so small they could be inserted by a hypodermic needle in vaccination programs. But he said this, very important. He said it's not just electronic tagging, so some computer knows where everyone is. It's not just what the microchip sends to the computer, it's what's sent the other way. And he said they can, from a central point, once people are microchipped, they can manipulate them emotionally. Why? Because emotions come through and are an expression of the biological computer, the DNA. They can manipulate you mentally, same reason, and they can manipulate you physically. And when you look at a computer, it has a central processing unit, which is actually known as the brain of the computer by many people. And the central processing unit in the biological computer we call the physical body is the physical brain, the human brain. Now, in a computer, the CPU, the central processing unit, is a microchip. Once they get a microchip inside us, which are far more sophisticated than they're telling us, they can manipulate the communication going around the computer, around the body. And that communication involves emotional communication, This is why when we feel emotions, we create chemicals in the body. This is why when we receive chemicals, it affects us emotionally, because one is a reflection of the other. It can affect the way we think and our ability to think rewiring, if you like, the messages are going around the computer, and fundamentally it can affect us physically. And they can isolate someone individually, or they can do it en masse once they get a microchip. Now that's the real agenda behind the microchip. And anyone that says, it'll make things ever so much easier. You know, I can go through the supermarket and I can just put me microchip on me hand and pay me bill, and it's ever so quick, and no queues now. Well, you know, do you want a queue in the supermarket for 10 minutes, or do you want your mind, your emotions, and your physical body control taken away from you? Hey, it's a bit of a choice there. Which one shall I make? Because that's the choice we're facing.
How do they come up with the plan to force people to do this, David? Because I think it's going to come down to where they say, you can't get a job, folks, unless you have one, or we're going to do away with cash, so you have to have a chip. That's the only way you're going to be able to get by.
Perfect summary, George. Absolutely. What they're doing in this country, Mr. Blair, who is a, you know, front man, clone, yes man for this Illuminati. That's why he gets manipulated into power. Do you know we have in this great democracy, Great Britain, you know, we now have a government with absolute power, Blair, in his third term, and he got 35% of the vote. 65% of the people of this country voted against him, and he got absolute power. But we live in a free world. The people have spoken. I've got my mandate, he said. Nonsense, but that's the way it works. But what they're doing now is they're bringing proposing ID cards, totalitarian tiptoe. What they're saying, first of all, is, oh, it's only voluntary. You know, you don't have to have one. But then what they start doing is, as you rightly say, is suddenly, well, if you're unemployed, you can't get your unemployment benefit unless you have a card. Oh, and you can't do this unless you have an ID card, because we need ID. And what they're saying is eventually, a few years after they're first introduced, they're going to be compulsory. And you will not be able to function without an identity card. Now, because we haven't yet seen the other little horrors they have up their sleeves, their future 9/11s of various kinds, we are now looking at ID cards, and we're thinking, oh, well, they're not coming in until 2000 and whatever. But that's what they're saying now, and they're talking ID cards now. My feeling is that there is a very good chance that they won't be talking ID cards by the time ID cards become compulsory. They'll be talking microchips.
When we come back, David, and we'll take phone calls next, is there this bigger picture of why? What do they know that maybe we don't? Is something happening that they think they need total control worldwide? Do they know there's an asteroid coming? What do you think it is? We'll be right back.